This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 22nd, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 361. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature is a double feature with two guests. First, Mario Canseco of Research Co. helps me set the stage for BC's 43rd provincial election. His latest poll says it'll be a close race between the NDP and Conservatives on the way to October 19th. And North Vancouver schoolteacher John O'Flynn was one of the 90 candidates who did not win last week's federal by-election in Montreal. He ran for another reason, as a protest in favor of electoral reform. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. And by the time you hear this, the 43rd BC election will be officially underway. Voting day is October 19th. There are 93 ridings up for grabs this time, up from 87 in 2020. Increased population means more seats, six new ridings, but 72 of the older ridings have new boundaries. Some of them have new names. So a whole new ballgame in many ways. At dissolution, the NDP held a majority with 55 seats, the Conservatives 8, the Greens 2. BC United, which is no longer a force, had 20. In January, it looked like the NDP had an easy path to another majority under David Eby because of the split between BC United and the BC Conservatives. However, that got solved over the summer. Kevin Falcon shocked BC on August 28th, pulling his party out of the election effectively, making the Conservatives the free enterprise alternative to the NDP. The latest poll from Mario Canseco's Research Co. shows a statistical tie. This month, David Eby has flip-flopped, adopting conservative positions against the carbon tax and in favor of involuntary custody of people with serious mental illness and addictions. David Eby's NDP, according to this new research poll, is supported by 44% of respondents and John Rustad's Conservatives, 42%. We're on our way to October 19th. Will it end that way? Will it end with the NDP with 44% of seats and Conservatives 42%? What is your prediction?
I think what we're seeing is a return to the way in which the province handled itself for most of the elections in the century. If you discount the blowout in 2001 by the BC Liberals and the massive victory in 2020 for the NDP, this is essentially where we always are. You know, both parties, one from the center left, one from the center right, at around 42, 43%, just fighting over small pieces of real estate. The domination of the Conservatives in areas, particularly in the Fraser Valley and in southern British Columbia, is something that is very different from what we saw in July, when we still had a lot of people flirting with BC United in those places. And we still see the NDP ahead in Vancouver Island and in Metro Vancouver. So it could ultimately come down to a very close election, specifically in areas where the Conservatives can grow. You know, maybe they can win a couple of seats in northern and central Vancouver Island, start to run the numbers a little bit more in the Fraser Valley, where the NDP won 7 of 9 seats in 2020, and now a lot of those seats seem to be up for grabs. And then what happens with the Greens? Will they be able to elect a member or two? What happens with some of those independents? But in a way, this is the starting gun for this particular campaign. Is eerily similar to the one we had in 2005 and 2009. There's a party that is in government that is slightly ahead, and a party that is in opposition trying to establish an emotional connection with voters. Carol James couldn't do it satisfactorily in 2005 and 2009 to become premier. We'll see if John Rostad fares differently.
What's different this time is something that's actually been the same for several months, if not the last couple of years. The big three issues, the big three double-digit issues, have really not changed. According to your new poll, 41% of respondents list housing, homelessness, and poverty as their top issue. Then you got healthcare, 21%, economy and jobs, 14%. Then it gets slim pickings from there. Crime and public safety is at 6%, environment is at 4%. So crime and public safety could be the wild card, but those three issues locked in are what the parties are already messaging about.
Well, and it's important because of just how complex the solutions on some of those issues are. It's with housing, you don't have a large runway to say these are the units that have been built. It's ultimately asking people to look into the future and to imagine the ramifications of your plan. The economy is a little bit easier. You can implement something that can garner the attention of voters, particularly those aged 18 to 34, who are looking at affordability, not necessarily as a housing issue, but also about having the salaries that they need in order to afford a place. It's one thing to say that you're building more, that you're making it easier for people to acquire property, but if the wages don't keep up with that, it's going to be very complicated. And healthcare is still a very important issue for people age 55 and over. It's clear that there are certain aspects of the system that aren't working very well for everybody. And this is one of the areas in which John Rothstein and the conservatives can establish that connection. But they are ahead when it comes to issue management. Rothstein has the edge on crime and public safety. It's an issue that they'll hammer extensively over the next few weeks. And there's essentially a tie when it comes to the economy. So it's not a surprise to see the NDP leader dominating on issues such as healthcare or housing. But if this becomes a referendum on economic management and the economic future, the message of the conservatives could be the one that delivers them the victory.
Now, you found through responses to your poll that EB and Rustad are tied for the best premier, the preference among respondents. They think that either or could be the best premier. Among men, it's Rustad and EB tied for best premier, but among women, EB gets a slight nod. 60% of voters who supported the BC Liberals in 2020 now support the Conservatives, but 29% of BC Liberal voters from 2020 now support the NDP. I assume that would be from people who are normally federal liberal.
Well, what we have is a scenario where the dream of every single BC United supporter moving into the Conservatives because Kevin Holcomb told them to do so has not materialized. You know, there's people who are still making their minds. And, you know, part of what we have as well is there are some independents who are very well known. I guess one of the surprises from the survey was to see 16% of voters in Northern British Columbia saying, I'm voting for an independent. You know, there's people who are very well known who have served as MLAs for a while and who could actually receive those votes. Now, whether that actually propels them to victory is a whole different ballgame. But I think part of what we're seeing is the voter for the BC Liberals in 2020, who was maybe not particularly satisfied with the way John Horgan was doing things or with the way the pandemic was being managed, looking for a different home now that there's no BC United. And by a 2-to-1 margin, they are going to the Conservatives in favor of the NDP. But it's not overwhelming. I think we still have a lot of people who are trying to see where they go with this. And you know, I still think we may have some more announcements related to independents who are running, and we may not have everybody on the list of candidates by September 28th. I think as an independent, you run into a very difficult situation when it comes to fundraising and organizing. And you know, there might be some who are ready to fight now, and then when they realize just how complicated this can be and the efforts that they'll have to put into it, decide that to withdraw their names before the deadline ends.
Yeah, there are several BC United candidates who didn't catch on with the Conservatives for one reason or another. You've got Mike Bernier and Dan Davies up north. And in Richmond, you've got Jackie Lee and Wendy Yuen. Karen Kirkpatrick in West Vancouver Capilano has announced that she's going to run. Do any of these people have a chance to win, to be spoilers? Could they split the vote and help the NDP?
It's a combination of both because you could be looking at ridings where the level of support for the Conservatives drops dramatically because of the presence of a former BC United candidate. So this means that if you're projecting the Conservatives to get 41, 42% of the vote and 11% of that vote is going to the independent who's well known, then that could enable the NDP to win that seat with 32, 33% of the vote. So it's the kind of split that the NDP was salivating for just 6 months ago when it seemed that the people were breaking evenly between the Conservatives and BC United. This could still happen, but it's Looking back at the 2020 election, the best performing independent was Lom in Chilliwack. And he was a local councillor, very well known, and got fewer than 25% of the vote. So you need to be closer to the 35 to 40% mark to actually win a race. And he thought it was the best moment for him to do so. He's still a councillor. He went back to his job in municipal politics. But with an election that could ultimately be a referendum about change, it's going to be hard for somebody who ultimately in the final stages of the election is looking to elect the government to say that they'll take a chance on an independent who may or may not hold the balance of power. So I think that is also part of the complexity that we're going to see. We might have people who are window shopping in the early stages of the campaign and saying, I really like my independent candidate and I'll send them to Victoria again. But if this becomes a very close race and people want to choose a government, they might end up gravitating more towards the NDP candidate or the Conservative candidate in their riding.
And finally, going back to the leaders, the characteristics of leaders and who's better at handling issues, what have you found on those counts?
Well, there's certainly an increase. We asked this question originally back in June, and we had a lot of people who didn't actually believe that the leaders embodied the characteristics that you want to see on a politician. This is a question that I've been asking for more than a decade. We asked it for the first time during the U.S. presidential election back in 2012. And what we see is more people who are identifying with the two main leaders. There's an increase for both John Rostad and David Eby as being good leaders, people who are ready to understand the problems of average British Columbians, and also being good speakers and communicators. There's a little bit of a shift as well for Sonia Furstenau. Her best trait is being honest and trustworthy. It's the best numbers that she has on all of these questions. But part of what we're seeing also is a situation where you start to develop animosity towards the other side. If you're somebody who supports Eby and believes that Eby is the best manager for things in the province, you're more likely to believe that Rostad is somebody who shouldn't be elected, and vice versa. If you're somebody who's already on the Conservative camp, you're going to be more upset with everything that the NDP is doing. The issue management questions are important because we do see something that resembles what we used to see in the Gordon Campbell versus Carol James's elections. Campbell usually dominated on the economy, and that is happening with Rostad, albeit not with a significant lead. Campbell was also seen as better for crime and public safety, and this is happening with Rostad as well. But we still see David Eby climbing the charts on healthcare and on housing, which are also important issues to manage. He does better on issues such as childcare and seniors care. He's also seen as a better person to manage relationships with municipal governments. So it's an opportunity to see just how much John Rostad can bridge this gap. And we continue to see the same situation related to gender that we see on the best premier question or on the voting intention question. Men tend to believe that this is the moment for somebody else to handle things. And women seem to believe that the NDP is better suited for a lot of this issue. So how they connect in the next few weeks and whether the needle starts to move a little bit more is going to be crucial for the Conservatives' chances. It's very difficult to change the government unless the person who would become the premier gets closer to the level of support on the best premier question that the incumbent has. We saw that in 2017, John Horgan getting really close to Christy Clark on that indicator. Similar situation in recent elections that we've covered. Wapke Nu was significantly superior on that question in the latter stages of the Manitoba campaign, and that is why the government changed. So there's time for Rostad to try to assemble a campaign that allows people to establish that emotional connection with him. And if he starts to get closer to Eby or even surpass him on the best premier question, then there will definitely be a change of government.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the podcast, Mario Canseco of Research Co. And look forward to having you back on the podcast during this campaign as we work our way to October 19th.
Definitely. Thanks, Paul.
There were two federal by-elections on September 16th, watched very closely across the country because of the state of the federal Liberal minority government under Justin Trudeau. In Elmwood, Transcona in Winnipeg, the NDP's Leila Dance beat Conservative Colin Reynolds by just 158 votes. The Liberal finished a distant third with less than 5% of the popular vote. In the Montreal area riding of LaSalle, Imard Verdun, a slim 248-vote win for the Bloc Québécois' Louis-Philippe Savard in a Liberal stronghold. My guest is one of the 90 people who didn't win in the Montreal by-election. He's John O'Flynn, a regular reader, loyal reader of the Breaker.News and listener of the Breaker.News podcast. He was part of the longest ballot protest to draw attention to the need for electoral reform. John O'Flynn is a West Vancouverite who is a school teacher in North Vancouver. He garnered 12 votes, which is actually quite something because John told me he doesn't have any family in that riding. John, how did you get your name on this ballot in the Montreal area riding by-election?
Thanks, Bob, for the introduction. And I was paying attention to a by-election that was happening in Toronto, St. Paul's, and I was noticing that there were a lot of candidates in that particular by-election of a few months ago. There were 84 candidates in that by-election. I think it got a bit of note because one of the candidates received zero votes, and that was sort of being spoken of as rather historic. And of course, the 84 candidates on that riding of Toronto St. Paul. And so I kind of figured out that there was this organization called the Longest Ballot Committee, and that they were trying to engage citizens across this country to avail of what is available to all of us, is that we can run in any riding, any constituency, as long as we meet the other criteria of a certain age and a Canadian citizen and being in good standing, and that this is available to all of us as Canadian citizens. And I learned that they were wanting to send a message about displeasure in regards to the first past the post system. And I know that in British Columbia, it has been a topic over a couple of decades where citizens' groups have had an opportunity to bring conversation to the province of British Columbia, where we as British Columbians had a chance to vote on a couple of occasions about other systems than the first past the post system. So when I saw how what the potential was to be a candidate in this LaSalle Imard Verdun, I contacted the organizers and expressed my interest to be a candidate. And there on the ground, volunteers went into the riding, gathered up 100 nominating signatures for myself and probably about 74 in total of Canadians across this country that had an interest to stand. And that's how I found my way to being on the ballot, being one of 91 yesterday on September 16th.
You weren't running to win, but you were running to help send a message with a group of other people.
So what I liked very much about was seeing how a lot of interested Canadians were wanting to be a part of this. There was an 18-year-old who was first opportunity to vote. And from that riding of in Montreal, Mark Mutter, I think was his name. And he first opportunity to vote, his first opportunity to be a candidate, and very passionate about wanting to see change to the have electoral reform. I heard him speak. He received about 19 votes out of that riding. But I do want to say that there are examples across this country where this conversation has taken place besides our own province. And I do think that this ballot, you know, over 40% of constituents had the experience of voting on this ballot, certainly would have got their attention, would have been noted in the media quite a lot. A lot of people conversation, complaining, wondering why this is happening. And so a lot of conversation coming out of it. And so for me, it was a very productive exercise to be a part of and to be part of electoral history.
And you point out something very interesting just by having your name on the ballot in a riding in the Montreal area, and you're a West Vancouverite and work as a school teacher in North Vancouver, that in the Canadian system, this doesn't just happen federally, but provincially as well, municipally too, a candidate doesn't need to live in his or her jurisdiction where he or she wants to become a public office holder.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I remember running provincially, and I'm pretty sure that Ujjal Dosanjh did not live in Vancouver, Kensington, but lived across the street from the riding. I remember in history where we have individuals like Jagmeet Singh seeking to be a member of parliament and coming all the way to Burnaby to do so. I remember John Turner running in Vancouver Quadra. We have seen it play out with leaders of parties running in different places. It is something interesting about our system that you can do it. I think at the end of the day, you still need residents from those areas to allow your name to stand on the ballot. And so the work has to be put in to find residents of that writing, and 100 had to be found. And I think people are very generous. I think people are very kind. I think when they hear someone is looking to be a candidate running somewhere and they're looking to get that opportunity, most citizens are more than prepared to sign nominating forms to help them get that opportunity. There's no commitment to voting for that person. If 100 people had nominated me, but 12 individuals in that riding decided to choose me as their choice, I'm pleased, of course. But it is something about Canada at these levels that one doesn't necessarily need to be a resident, but one needs to be a citizen. One needs to be of age. One needs to be of character and understands the responsibilities that they're looking to take on if elected. And that I felt okay doing that myself.
Now, just to be a devil's advocate, there may be people out there that will look at the very long 91 name ballot. And for those who didn't have a serious campaign wanting to win, they might call you a little bit mischievous, maybe abusing the system. What do you say to those people?
Well, listen, there were 11 parties represented on that ballot, and then those of no affiliation and those that are independent. When I looked at the Manitoba, the other by-election that you spoke about, we saw that there were no independents, nobody with no affiliation. There were 6 or 7 parties running. And so the party system, certainly this first past the post system is a favor to these parties, especially the ones that are successful and able to get in through the first past the post. But as you can see, even in Montreal, there's a lot of perspectives, a lot of viewpoints by the 11 parties that ran candidates. For me, I know that people sometimes are members of party and then are no longer welcome to be a member of that party. They wish to run and engage once more in the process like they're doing here in British Columbia. You have sitting MLAs who are with the party, find themselves no longer with the party, have the ability to run as independents. That's a beautiful thing. And so when you have citizens and like here in British Columbia wanting to engage the people, just like myself and others want to engage and contest, it's a beautiful thing that we can do so. And listen, there were 2 candidates who got 0 votes in that riding. And the 2 at the bottom. Now, sure, that could have been me just as easily, right? But at the end of the day, as you know, for the 12 that chose me, very grateful. And for those parties, some of those parties only receive 40 votes, 100 votes, but they do represent perspective and viewpoint. And if there was something other than first past the post system, and just like we examined here in British Columbia about looking for a more consensus, more conversation on decision-making that a lot of parts of our world make use of, transferable votes, ranking systems, preferential, proportional. We see it happening around the world, and I believe it can allow for better governance. And so those who had this moment with that very long ballot, some came with purpose for their party. And as you know, about 8,000 people were focused on the main parties, but there were thousands of others who were looking to others and were prepared to put an X and exercise their votes. For them, I'm grateful.
Could there be other ways that a system could be reformed? Could there be things such as a none of the above box on the ballot. If enough voters say, nah, the people on this ballot aren't there for me, I don't trust any of them, let's have a do-over. Or could there be something else, such as term limits? They've got term limits in the United States. We don't have term limits here. We've got politicians that have been in the legislature in Victoria for 20, 30 years. Should there be legislation to limit that to 8 or 12 years so that there's a constant turnover? What else can be done?
Well, you know, Bob, you hit a lot of different things there that I'm sure have come into citizens' assemblies when independent groups have come together like they did in British Columbia and other parts of our country, where these conversations are being held by citizens. And so I find that we need to look for those opportunities again. When it is the main political parties that are setting the terms, setting the rules, how can you think that politicians, incumbents, are going to be open to the different opinions and perspectives, the things that you've spoken about, things about that other Canadians have spoken about? It needs to be independent. It needs to people of citizens that are examining reform, and that they have the materials and engagement, the resources given to them as it was given to British Columbians. We need to see this happen in other jurisdictions. Yes, you mentioned October 19th, super excited. I have candidates that are running in North Vancouver Lonsdale. I already have had Minister Bowen Ma has been in one of my classes to speak about her role and responsibilities, also to address the fact that she's running for re-election. I'm going to be having the Conservative candidate coming in, visiting all four of my classes, David Splett. I'm trying to bring these candidates in so that the young voters in the school can get to know who the players are. It is quite clear that maybe in North Vancouver Lonsdale, maybe there's only going to be two candidates. Will there be other candidates, other choices for the 60,000 constituents of North Vancouver Lonsdale? It's important that students are hearing and learning that what are some of the unique and interesting things about our country and the system that we choose to use with First Past the Post. Having been a candidate at the federal level and at the provincial and at the local level helps me to bring some insight as one who has contested, also being one who votes and wants to see more choice on the ballot, and to look at the individuals that are putting up their hand. Every candidate there is an equal. All 91 of us were equal before the people. And so when we come to the British Columbia election, when you see those names, they are all equal until we know that one gets the most votes, gets to step forward in that representative role. And so it's always, for me, good, important, educational, and knowing that the federal election is around the corner makes it even more interesting, knowing that you have a minority government in Ottawa, that's where it's the most vulnerable. Here, we've had an NDP, a majority government, that's able to run out its term. These are good educational conversations, and we're doing it. We need to do it with our youth. And we need good voter turnout. There's just no doubt about it. British Columbians, show up on October 19th and cast your ballot and be ready to show up for the federal election. Engage, show model to your families that the importance of you participating. And if you are thinking about it being a candidate, it is quite possible for you to. Do not be afraid, and don't be afraid. And don't be afraid to be an equal on the ballot.
Well, thank you again to John O'Flynn for being my guest on this edition of the podcast. John O'Flynn of West Vancouver, he's a school teacher in North Vancouver, and he was one of the 91 candidates in the Montreal area riding of LaSalle, Amard, Verdun, where he had 12 votes.
Thank you, Bob Mackin, and thank you for your great work. Thank you.
Time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, 23 Taiwanese charged with spying for China. Spy ring includes serving Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard officers. China reportedly paid out $156,000 over more than 2 years in return for sensitive information supplied by the Ring. Prosecutors confiscated 69 phones, 103 computer hard drives and flash drives, 9 secret military documents, and 1 confidential government document. In ABC News Australia, the socially awkward karaoke lover who allegedly created an app for the underworld. Australia's federal police allege Ghost was created by J.J. Yoon Jung 9 years ago and has been used solely by the criminal underworld to organize high-level drug importation and trafficking, threats to kill, and the sale of firearms by crime syndicates globally. They say the app was favored by Italian gangs in Victoria, bikers in Western Australia, and Middle Eastern organized crime syndicates in New South Wales. In the Anchorage Daily News, U.S. sends soldiers to Alaska Island amid increase in Russian military activity. The U.S. military has moved about 130 soldiers along with mobile rocket launchers to Shemya Island in the Aleutians. 8 Russian military planes and 4 Navy vessels, including 2 submarines, have come close to Alaska in the past week as Russia and China conducted joint military drills. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, Oregon politics is awash in alcohol industry donations. The Oregon Beverage Political Action Committee spends more than $300,000 every year, much of it on contributions to the campaigns of the state's top politicians. Its biggest funder is Columbia Distributing, the Portland beverage distributor with reported earnings of $200 million a year. Oregon's tax on beer is the lowest in the U.S., according to the Oregon Health Authority. The rate on wine is the second lowest. In Crosscut, Washington's carbon auction prices and gas prices are down from 2023. Washington raised $237.2 million, bringing 2024's cap and invest revenue up to $561.7 million, with one more quarterly auction to go. Carbon-emitting corporations, including oil companies, bid every 3 months on state allowances for their pollution emissions. In 2023, the first year of the new program, quarterly auctions brought in about $2 billion. Prices were blamed for adding up to 50 cents per gallon of gas. And in the Breaker.News, read these stories. No charges for pro-China campaign to unseat conservative Chu, despite evidence of foreign interference. And fatal wedding crash driver fined, banned from driving for 5 years. You can read these stories and more at thebreaker.news.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to coaches. Coaches who help teams be their best on and off the field of play. It's Coaches Week in BC until September 22nd. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 22nd, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 22nd of September in 1919, the steel strike began in Pennsylvania? It spread across the U.S. until early in 2020. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.